Time to talk science now, though, and Hong Kong has confirmed its first human case of bird flu since 2003. The city was the centre of the world's first major outbreak among humans back in 1977, when six people died of the then unknown mutation of the virus. This latest positive case is a 59-year-old woman who'd recently returned from mainland China. The WHO says it isn't sounding the alarm, saying that this case fits the existing pattern of occasional human infection. They're a bit more alarmed than that, though, in Hong Kong. And Chris Smith is a virologist. He's also our weekly science correspondent, and he joins us from Cambridge. Chris, hello there.
Hello, Fran.
Now, in recent years, the world's been more focused on swine flu, Chris, not bird flu or the avian influenza. Should we be surprised that bird flu has re-emerged in Hong Kong?
Well, this is what people who have been commentating on flu and advising governments and the World Health Organization on flu for a long time have been saying. We mustn't take our eye off the ball, because although people were very much focused on swine flu, H1N1, last year, the threat of H5N1, which is avian flu, hasn't gone away. It continues to lurk, flapping its wings from time to time on the horizon. And actually, looking at the WHO's current reports, I was just looking at the returns, because people all over the world return data on how many cases and how many deaths they've had on these infectious diseases, including H5N1. And China this year has to date returned in 2010 one case and one death as of mid-October from H5N1. But other parts of the world have very large amounts of activity. If you look at Egypt, for example, I'm just looking at the chart now, it's showing 22 cases with 9 deaths from H5N1. And Vietnam is also very active, 7 cases there and 2 deaths. So the virus hasn't gone away. It continues to sit there, posing a potential threat. At the moment, it doesn't appear to be able to spread very well between people, which is why you see these probably transmissions directly from a bird into a person. They make the person very ill, but the virus isn't very good at spreading into new humans yet, so it's a sort of dead-end host, quite literally, when a person gets it.
And that's the fear, that's the great fear, I suppose, and since 1997, that's what the research has been looking into, how to stop that happening and make sure it doesn't happen. But that transmission from a bird to a human, do we know any more about how that happens?
Well, we think it's probably a symptom of intensification of agriculture and animal husbandry. The lady who is this case in Hong Kong, she'd actually travelled to mainland China. I was looking at the reports earlier. She went to Nanjing, she went to Shanghai and a couple of other places, as well as her journeying around to see relatives and things, and then came back to Hong Kong. So in all of those places, there will now be an epidemiological effort focused on asking, well, what was she in contact with? What's the animal reservoir? Because the thing about China is that it's a marketplace economy in many places. So there will be animals brought together in large numbers, having been farmed very intensively in one part of the country, and then juxtaposed alongside other animals, often of different species and types, in that market. And there's a perfect opportunity, like almost a mixing pot, for viruses to jump from one species to another. And that's probably how SARS got started, actually, in 2003, which was the other major pandemic spawned out of Hong Kong. Mm. And so people are very concerned about these mechanisms, and therefore highlighting them, and then educating people to try to minimise the risk, because as the human population rises, there's now 6.8 billion of us on Earth, we're going to need more food. That means that there is more pressure on agriculture and animal husbandry, and that means that the opportunity for these kind of viruses to amplify in animal hosts and then jump into humans is going to get even more of a threat unless we take this seriously.
Now you're worrying me, Chris. Chris, let's talk about cataract surgery. It's one of the world's most commonly performed surgical procedures, and at the moment, surgeons actually make a physical incision at the edge of the eye, which is amazing when you think about it. Now research into using laser technology here.
Well, Daniel Palanca is a researcher at Stanford University in America, and he's got a paper with many colleagues in Science Translational Medicine this week, and they have come up with a technique which should take some of the risk out of cataract surgery. On the whole, it's very safe surgery, and it's very common, as you say. 1 in 3 adults in the developed world will need cataract surgery at some point in their life. But there's one aspect of cataract surgery which is still very much a chance. It's the riskiest bit. Now, when you do a cataract procedure, what the ophthalmologist is doing is removing a lens from the front part of the eye which has become fogged, usually by age, but there are other disease processes that make that lens foggy, and this, of course, cuts down visual visual acuity, it means that the person's perception of colour isn't so good and people perform less well in low light. And so the treatment is to go in, you remove that lens and replace it with a prosthetic implant. And you put that implant into a structure called the lens capsule, which is a bag which sits between the front part of the eye and the back part of the eye and normally houses that lens. To get the old lens out, though, and to get the new lens in, you have to go into the front part of the eye and then painstakingly cut a hole, it's got to be a round hole, in that bag to then break up the lens, usually using ultrasound, get it out and then slot in the prosthesis. If you don't make a nice round hole, then you can end up with weak spots, because if you imagine if you've got corners, then forces can focus at those corners and you can get a tear, and this weakens the structure and that's bad. So this is just down to the skill of the surgeon painstakingly picking this round hole using a needle and then taking out the lens and putting a new one in. This new system that they've come up with uses a laser, and the first thing it does is it is applied to the front of the eye. It then maps the front part of the eye and the lens structure and the membranes and the capsule inside the eye. It then uses short bursts of femtoseconds, very, very short, 10 to the minus 15 second long bursts of laser to cut a perfectly round hole in that membrane, in the capsule, and it then also is used to break up the lens so that then you can go in much less invasively to remove those bits of lens and then slot in the prosthesis. And they've done a trial. Initially they worked this up using fake eyes and pig's eyes and rabbit's eyes and things to make sure it was safe. Now they've done a trial on 50 humans. It wasn't a blind trial, I'm pleased to add. But what they did do is to do a crossover trial. So they recruited 50 people, and 30 plus of those people had the procedure done with the laser on one eye, and they had the standard surgical technique in the other eye. And what they found is that the people had no negative outcomes, but they did have slightly better visual acuity and slightly less edema, swelling in the eye when they had it done by laser. And they argue that this is evidence that this should now be done more generally with a bigger clinical trial to see whether the laser can significantly improve outcomes in particular tricky cases.
Chris, thank you very much for joining us. Talk to you again next week.
Thanks, Fran.
Chris Smith, our regular science correspondent, joining us there from Cambridge. It's 17 to 7 on Breakfast.